My name is Megan Brett Hamilton. I'm a speech-language pathologist and assistant professor, and I'm so glad you're here listening to the Honeybee Connection podcast by MB. This is your podcast to understand how language, culture, and other parts of our identity play a role in how we communicate. In each episode, I have a pretty awesome one-on-one conversation with my guest. Then I offer tips and insight into how we can better communicate with each other, with a focus on language and culture. All right, let's get started. My guest today is Fung Ban. Fung is the director of IT at Montgomery College in Maryland and serves as an adjunct faculty member there teaching computer science. Fung is also a close friend of my brother's, but as you can see, when you're only a year apart in school, lots of relationships start to overlap. So I can't help it, guys. It is what it is. In this conversation with Fung, I learned so much about his life before Silver Spring, Maryland. Before coming to Silver Spring, he grew up in Vietnam, where he was the youngest of 10 children. When he arrived to Maryland, he was 10 years old and only spoke a minimal amount of English. And when I talked to Fung, he weaves this beautiful story where he connects ideas about language, culture, and communication with his own personal experiences of immigration and assimilation. You're not going to want to miss this. Let's listen. So hello, everyone. This is Megan Brett again. We are here with another episode of Honeybee Connection podcast. And today we have Fung Ban. Did I pronounce that last name correctly?
That's correct.
Awesome. He is another one of my childhood friends, technically my brother's friend, but I like to steal some friends. And grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland, like we did. So today we're going to talk to Fung a little bit about language, culture, communication, and anything else he wants to share.
Okay.
So.
You too.
All right, Fung, talk to me about growing up in Silver Spring, Maryland. What did it mean to you?
Well, I spent most of my life here, right? I came to the United States in 1986, so right then, plop right into Silver Spring. And most of my life growing up is adapting to the culture. And I think being in Silver Spring is easier to adapt to the American culture, right? So right off the bat in school, I don't think it's as multicultural as I see it now, but I think it's back in the day, back in 1986, is still a very diverse area. So a lot of my growing up is due to being in school and the friends that I made in school. And I think one of the memories that I'm very fond of in Silver Spring is I think everybody who lives here know Tasty Diner, right? So I think this is like in my earlier adult age, right? So that's one of the places that my friends and I love to hang out. We'll hang out there until like 3 or 4 in the morning, listening to the jukebox by the table. So I think because of the diversity of this county and this area, it makes growing up much easier. And why I say it's much easier is because now that I have traveled more throughout the country, I see other segments of the populations and geographically, there are a worse place to grow up. How about that?
I like how you put that. Yes. Very nice.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. Okay. So I like Tasty Diner. Oh my goodness. The memories on, I can't remember the Rockville Pike. Yeah. Rockville Pike. Yeah. Awesome. Okay. So now we shift gears just a little bit so I can get into it. Tell me about where you learned to talk, how you learned to talk, what kind of influences you had.
Okay. So I think that's, for me personally, that seems like a complicated story. So I did not grow up from since I was born to I was 10 years old, I was living mainly in Vietnam. And being in Vietnam, I'm ethnically Chinese and so is my family. And we live in this little enclave in Vietnam where there's only Chinese people, right? So I grew up speaking Chinese as my primary language, even though we were in Vietnam. So just like anybody who grew up, like even for the English speaker who lives here, you grow up, you learn the language by interaction of your parents, your family, and all those things. So that's how I learned Chinese. And then and being in a setting like Vietnam, I also absorb other languages like Vietnamese. And then I also learn other dialects of Chinese because there's other dialects of Chinese people that were there. So when we were immigrated here, we have a temporary stopover in the Philippines refugee camp. And we were there for a little more than six months, seven, 8 months kind of thing. And I think being at that young of an age, I think everybody said language is easier to absorb by somebody who's younger. So while I was there, I was able to absorb the native Filipino language, right? So, but by the time I left the Philippines, I got here in August 1986, right before school start, right? So they placed me into fourth grade, right? So Questhaven Elementary near White Oak kind of a place. So, and just to refer back to my earlier statement where I see that the county and Silver Spring itself is much more diverse now than when I was there, is because when I was dropped into the elementary school in Questhaven, I didn't see that much program that support second language speakers, and especially a fresh immigrant like myself. So I was dropped straight into a normal fourth grade class, right? Everybody in that class have been friends since kindergarten or preschool, and I'm this stranger coming in. More than being a stranger coming in, I know nothing of the language. And one would say, "Well, didn't you learn it while you're in Vietnam or Philippines?" Which, yes, I did. You know, when you are outside of the country, you're being taught by non-native speaker of English, and you are taught the very textbook kind of thing, and the pandemic. And without the context of it, right? So even though technically, yes, I've been educated at a certain level in English. So I'm sitting in my fourth grade class. That was the hardest year to simulate, right? So everybody's, including the teacher, speaking English, going through the curriculum, talking, reading books, and having small group sessions where I'm unable to contribute. More than unable to contribute, I don't even know what's going on, right? They do have some kind of support for new immigrants. They do have ESOL class, but ESOL class is not as extensive as it is these days. It is 1 hour a day where they pull you out of your homeroom class and go to this ESOL class. And that's just one, I think once a day, or I don't even know if it's as regular as once a day. So for me, the assimilation into the American culture, and specifically the language of it, is really throw into the fire right away, right? But luckily for me, being young, as I look back and compare myself to my older siblings who have not been able to assimilate and learn the English language that well, I think it's all due to my age at the time. So being right there every day, immersed into the American language, English itself, the American culture, I cannot tell you the specific mechanics of how I pick up the language, but I suspect, you know, you're learning subconsciously through people speaking and the context of what they're speaking and the repetition of those words. But throughout that year, by fifth grade, you know, I was able to hold my own in interacting with everyone else. And so that's my complicated journey to learn to speak English.
That is a lot. That is very complex. And it's amazing. I mean, 1 year took you 1 year and then you figured it out. I want to take a step back though. I want to go back to when you said you lived in Vietnam, your ethnic background is Chinese, mm-hmm. and your family spoke Chinese. And so that's what you learned to speak. Were there ever times during those 10 years where you felt, how do I word this? Where there was like an identity difference between living in a country where the majority of the people spoke one language and you spoke another language. Was there ever anything that felt off, misaligned, anything about your identity that was like, oh, you know, I feel uncomfortable, or no, I feel like I fit right in?
Right. That's a very good point. I think I did feel that difference in identity because of the language. I think that carry on over my life to here in the United States too. But when I was in Vietnam, when I was saying that a lot of the ethnically Chinese people live in this one community, kind of maybe on purpose separating themselves from the other main culture of Vietnam, and culturally it's also reinforced by my family, my parents, and other Chinese people that we are different, right? We are every time. I think here's the biggest thing as I learn in my life is that language is this. A lot of time is a tool for communication, but it's also a tool for creating barriers, right? So this tool for barrier is very distinctly reinforced for every Chinese kid. Like, you know, we're different. We are Chinese. We, by whatever happenstance through the war, whatever, we are here. And those are the main Vietnamese people are different from us. And we have this sense of value and they have that sense of value. And those taught values are very much reinforced by the difference in language. I think language is, we like it or not, is bigger than Trump's wall.
Agreed. And lovely way to put it. Yeah.
So, I think that carried over. I think with that experience, that carried over here in when I got to the United States and trying to assimilate into the culture, is that, you know, as long as I have that language barrier, I mean, even in Vietnam, I was able to absorb the Vietnamese language, and that barrier is lowered when you have a common tongue, right? So you understand people's intent, people's desire, people's value. Maybe from that you can build shared value through communication. But when I started here in America, you know, all that got reset to zero, right? I have this impenetrable barrier where you, even though we're humans, we think we have certain shared values, just the language itself can make yourself an alien or they are an alien. So that was a very hard thing to break through. But just like when I was growing up in Vietnam, as you assimilate more, as language comes, that foreign language to you at the time becomes less foreign, you see the melting away of the barriers, right? You do see each other as humans, and the desire is the same, the needs is the same. Everybody have this same security needs, same wants, and same hopes, right? So
thank you for sharing that. That was beautiful. So basically you have a lot of experience with lots of different languages and dialects, it appears too, from what you told me. First mm-hmm. of all, what do you, okay, so clearly we're speaking English right now. Thank yeah. you. In this current stage of your life, do you use other languages with family, with your children, with friends? I mean, do you speak any other languages currently?
I do. As I said, a large part of my family still have has various level of assimilation in language-wise, right? So it's a large portion of my siblings do speak some form, some level of English, but not in any fluent way. And especially my mom, who does not speak English at all. So I do retain the Cantonese dialect of Chinese, where I, when I go home, I do go home often, like once a week to every few days. I communicate with them purely through Chinese, the Cantonese dialogue. But as the other language that I have said I have acquired during my childhood, because of the lack of exercise of that muscle, right? So the only muscle I've exercised right now is my Cantonese and my English, and the other languages like Vietnamese and Mandarin and Filipinos have all disappeared.
Okay. What, I know you have children. How many children do you have?
Three.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to make an assumption that they speak English. Right. Did you have any desire for them to learn another language? I just talk to me a little bit about the languages they know, or they're obviously exposed to Cantonese, right? Just because I think when they go maybe visit their grandparents, perhaps. Yeah, yeah. But can you talk to me a little bit about your thoughts of the languages that your children speak?
Sure.
Or,
they also have a complicated language history too. So my ex-wife, she is Vietnamese, and she speaks English and Vietnamese, and her parents speak Vietnamese only, and my family speaks Chinese, and so my kids grew up primarily in the care, like daycare, with my ex-wife's parents. That's the funny thing. So they grew up with them, and they only speak primarily Vietnamese. My kids never absorb a word of Vietnamese. They completely don't understand it at all, and that's why I find weird. My common language with my ex-wife is English, and that's the only language they had grasped on, and they have very marginal contact once a week to my side of the family, and they don't, that is even a stranger language to them. So my mom, that's one of the things my mom keep harassing me is, why don't you spend the time and teaching Chinese? And I do feel bad about that, you know. I mean, I keep making excuses for myself. And, I have a life, I'm too busy, and I can't do this and that kind of thing. But I do feel bad about that, because to my mom and to, I'm sure to everybody else, language is more than a form of communication, is passing on a culture too. And I feel like I did not impart that culture for my kids. But at the same time, me as a parent, my primary concern is for their survival and their thriving their future here in America. And that's primary being English. And I want them to speak English well. I want them to write well. I want them to do well in math, science, arts, and all those things. And passing on that language culture has become a secondary or even tertiary in my mind.
I get that. I think it's, I mean, we said it before, I think it's complicated. I think it's complex. But what's also interesting is English has become a part of your culture, mm-hmm. right? So it's not like it's not a part of your culture. And so you are passing it down, in my opinion, to your children. It's just, you know, there's another part of your culture that's kind of been, you know, on the sidelines for right now. But I think it's complicated, you know, and I think it has to do with, again, this identity piece that we all have, you know, where, yes, part of your identity is that you are Chinese and you grew up in Vietnam and you speak Cantonese, but you also grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland, and, you know, you speak English and you have friends that speak English. So I think it's a matter of like, what parts of our culture do we pass down to our children? You know, we can't pass everything, but I do think it's, basically, don't be so hard on yourself, Fung, is what I'm trying to say. Yeah, like, don't be so hard on yourself. Yeah. I get it. I do. I get it. I get both sides. I get what your mom probably feels, but I also get what you probably feel too. So
right. And not to belabor on that point, I think, right, when I said that language is more than the act of communicating with one another, when you lose that language, you also lose that subtlety of culture, right? Because there's the many languages where you can't, there are certain phrases and there's certain ideologies that can't be directly translated one to another. Some language have words that describe something where another language completely don't care about that concept of that word. So therefore you don't have an equivalency. And those are the culture that are missing there, right?
I absolutely love that. There's a lot of controversy in the field of linguistics, cognitive neuroscience, that talks about, was it Wolfram's theory of language begets thought, and some people agree with it and some people don't. I don't know how you don't agree with it, because right, it's exactly what you just said. Can you give an example of a concept, an idea that is in one of your cultures but not in another?
Yeah, and specifically, more recently, one of that concept had jumped into my mind. I recently got a dog, right? So this little puppy, and I guess in this COVID time, everybody's getting puppies. So this is my puppy.
I didn't know that.
So this is my puppy. So one of the things this puppy is really, they're very energetic, right? They like to play and stuff like that. And sometimes when they, not just a puppy, like a kid or even an adult, when you get so into something, like for my dog, he's like, you're playing rough with him and he's playing rough back. And most of the time the dog knows how to pretend bite you. But sometimes when you get so emotionally involved, let's say the human, they might bite you too hard out of the heat of the moment kind of thing. There is a word in Chinese to describe that, but I cannot find a word in my head to describe that, because the word in Chinese, sometimes when you have a specific word to describe something, it all makes sense, right?
Yes.
You label something and it all just made sense.
Yes. But
if you don't have a label for it, it's like, I don't know how to say that to you.
Uh-huh. And then you're trying to like, you're really trying to be like, no, it's like, it's not even on the tip of your tongue. You're just kind of like, if you could just see the emotion inside me, then I can put it with a word and give it to you. And then you and I will now feel the same thing.
Exactly. That's
got it. Wait, what's the word? What's the word in Chinese?
Chinese is called yokan. It just means you are so passionate. You, the passion of the moment overcomes something, right? So,
I'm going to bring that to English. I love that. I love it. Okay. So, so you talked to me a little bit about your educational experiences when you first got here, right? Mm-hmm. So in fourth grade, you said that was a really, really hard year. Mm-hmm. And then fifth grade, better.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to share about your educational experiences? Did you feel like you really kind of did the best you could when you got to, you know, middle school, high school, or do you feel like other people had a better chance at succeeding academically because their first language was English? What are your thoughts on that?
I think I do have a thought on that. I think what I'm thinking here is, there is a part of personal responsibility in here too. I can't blame it on culture. Sometimes I do feel the native speaker who are born with who are born in immersed into the English language, the grammar of it. I do feel a disadvantage in that it is not within me to kind of to speak the language or understand the grammar, right? So since this is a learned skill after so many years, one thing I do struggle with is two things I do very much struggle with is public speaking and written communication, especially as you're a grown person right now in the business world. Written communication is very important, and my grammar. Written grammar, maybe spoken grammar, are horrific, right? and I could never get a hang of it, right? So even though now in my professional life, I'm lucky to have other people who are much well versed in the language to help me proofread and rewrite certain things, and I always seen that as a barrier for me, right? A barrier for me professionally that I need to overcome. And I think in my recent years, I have overcome the fear of public speaking. And my fear of public speaking since the beginning is really stemmed from my childhood being in this country. I always, when you don't know the language, you feel singled out. You feel there's a spotlight on you. And I'm lucky to be able to work through that, but the other part I still need to work through is my written communication, because, you know, when you have verbal communication, face-to-face communication, people do give you a sort of a handicap or a compensation. It's like, oh, he's from another country, I'll give him a break, but which I don't want that, right? I want to be treated by my ideas and how I communicate my ideas over it, not somebody give me a extra credit compensating for what I lack. But when in written communication, nobody sees that, right? Your word is, and the way you write your word, you compose your sentences and your paragraph matters. And what I'm really frustrated about the English grammar, right, is not a science, this is the art, right? And this,
I agree.
Very hard to predict.
Yep. I completely agree, because that is what I work with. Yeah. And there's all these rules, but then the rule changes with this exception, but then that exception changes with this rule. And then that rule, it's just,
exactly.
It is complicated. I like how you said it's an art, not a science. That's so funny. Yeah. Yeah. I know. So you said this is interesting. You talked about when people talk to you face to face, they hear you, right? They hear your accent. They mm-hmm. hear how you're talking. And so they give you, I don't know, some leeway or something, yeah. right? Can you talk to me about like an experience you've had when you've opened your mouth mm-hmm. and that person who's listening to you or the person you're having a conversation with reacts in a way that either offended you, reacts in a way that either made you feel, you know, passionate. I mean, just something where they were reacting to the way you spoke and you kind of did something with that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. That does make sense. I have to say, it's very hard for me to give you a concrete example, but I could give you a non-concrete example.
Perfect.
Okay, so my compensation, you know, everybody compensate with their perceived handicap. My compensation has always been throughout my adult life to be, especially in meetings and social situation, is to be quiet, right? Try to be nonverbal as possible and not to put a spotlight on myself. But as you grow up and you get into much more complicated work, and that's no more of a possibility. And why I say is a non-concrete example is because I feel, not necessarily it is reality or truth, but I feel the way I present myself, my accent, the way I look, or whatever, right? I feel my differences put me at a disadvantage, and I don't see people take me as seriously as other more fluent and more articulate in their thoughts, right? So,
mm-hmm. Got it. And I can't imagine. I can't imagine being a Black female, how that feels. I can't imagine how that feels. I know I have the advantage of speaking what we call in our mainstream American English, right? That's how I grew up speaking. So I know I have that advantage and privilege, but I also know that being Black and being a woman, I get, you know, absolutely. That kind of, yeah. You know, so I understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. So, okay. Well, you actually just talked about this. I was going to ask about, you know, how has the way that you talk intersected with your race, right? Your ethnicity, impacted your social world, your professional world. I think you've talked about that, but is there anything else you want to add about, you know, just kind of this intersection between your language, your culture, your identity, the social path that you've been on?
Yeah, I think one thing I didn't really talk too much about is it's an intersection with my personal social life. Megan, as you have grown up with me in high school, I don't know if you've ever noticed, like my social circle, my circle of friends have always been with other foreigners, not exclusively, but a large majority with other foreigners, because rightly or wrongly or so, I do feel, even though others have accepted me, I don't feel I am part of the more Americanized social group. So I have chosen to not participate. So that's kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, right? You know, I don't go to those prom parties or any of that, right? So I think that has been a disadvantage of me to fully assimilate and experience the American culture. But I think most of that is because of how I manifest how I feel, rather than it is an outside force excluding me.
Got it. That's so interesting, Fung. I know. And I've always realized, I mean, for me, you know, growing up and watching you and Michael be friends, I've always felt you've kept a small circle, right? I've always felt like it's been kind of like a small circle, like you and Michael and Philippe, and, you yeah. know, and you and Michael and Philippe. And Grant, I know you obviously have other friends other than, you know, Michael and Philippe, but I have always found it interesting. And I do find it interesting just to see how much, I mean, it's what you've said, and which is why I'm doing this podcast. I don't think we talk about language enough, you mm-hmm. know, and I think it's such an important part of who we are. And I think sometimes people take it for granted if it's something that doesn't shine a spotlight on you. Right. So if it's something that's just part of the mainstream society and you kind of fit right in, then of course you don't think about language. Of course you don't think about the way you talk. Yeah. But if it's something that either, you know, aligns with your racial ethnic identity and that identity is not mainstream.
Yeah.
Or like me, I feel like some people think there's a mismatch between the way I talk mm. and the race that I am.
Right.
Like, oh, but you're Black, so why do you talk like that? Right. So I'm like, yeah. So I think for people where the way you talk aligns with the way you look, you probably don't think about it as much as right. people like us.
Exactly. That's very true.
All right. So this has been awesome. I'm going to ask you to fill in the blank for two questions.
Mm-hmm.
They're not questions. They're fill in the blank. They're statements. Okay. So in your opinion, mm-hmm. and thinking about your life and professional life and everything, communication doesn't work when?
Communication doesn't work. There's a few things I can fill in, right? It doesn't work when you have no interest in that communication, or one of the party have no interest in that communication, so you have to both share that interest. And the other communication doesn't work is in times of emotional, heightened emotional state where each party in part of the communication decided, because of the heightened emotion, don't have the ability to listen, right? So somebody have to communicate, the other have to receive it. So if neither party is ready to receive it, communication is just words.
I love that. There's actually something in the communication world. I'm not a, you know, that's not where my area of research is particularly, but they call it noise.
Yeah.
And noise in any kind of way, right? Noise as in you're hungry, noise right. as in actual noise, noise as in I'm stressed.
Right.
Right. No, I love that. Okay. So then, and I keep saying I'm going to change this, but clearly I won't, because it's going to be the end of my series. It's the exact opposite statement, but try not to give me the exact opposite answer. Thanks. Okay. Communication works when?
Well, communication works. Not trying to repeat my opposite. No, communication works when there I guess when people are able to perceive shared values, right? So, or shared understanding. I could speak a different language, and for example, right now I speak English well. I hope so.
And you do.
let's say I'm communicating to somebody who don't speak English well and only speaks Spanish well, and I don't speak Spanish well. The only way we can communicate well if I understand that person is a human being and they have the same wants and needs as I do, and I have the assumption that they are nice and maybe they need help or I need help. And through that context, we can form communication even without language, and we can build a base so that we can start. That's how communication works, is mutual understanding.
I like that. And I love it, because what people don't always understand is communication is not always language.
Yeah.
Verbal language too. You know, it's gesture, it's facial expression. It's it's not doing anything. I love when people say, like, well, he didn't communicate with me. I'm like, no, that was communication. Exactly. That's exactly what that was. You were just expecting something different.
Exactly. And I think that the context of those gestures and body language also helped in that communication.
Of right? course. Yeah. Yeah. Context matters. The one thing that my students ever get from me when they leave my class, I'm like, context matters. Because they will ask me all sorts of questions looking for a very direct answer. And I'll say, it depends.
Yeah.
Because context matters.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Fung. Oh, I learned so much, didn't you? Anyways, stay tuned for some tips and insight that I took away from that conversation. I want to talk about a few things that Fung brought up. I want to talk about assimilation and the language choices that we make. I want to talk about how language can create barriers. And then finally, the language thought connection, which is pretty controversial. So let's start with assimilation. I really enjoyed listening to his journey, right? So how he, first of all, the beginning of it was fascinating to me, because he is of Chinese heritage, but he was being raised in Vietnam in a Chinese community, which I thought was really interesting, because it made me think a lot about America here and the assimilation process of people who are not in quote unquote mainstream society and are trying to assimilate there or not trying to assimilate, which, to be perfectly honest, is pretty much what our schools do, right? So I thought about his experience and I thought, wow, that does sound really familiar to me. I think about, you know, young Black children who live in Black communities and speak African-American English in their communities and feel safe there and comforted. And on the outside, when they go and journey to, you know, other places in their community or in their neighborhood, society, I won't say neighborhood community, I'll say society, then they are expected to speak a certain way, act a certain way, have these cultural values. And I think that was just interesting to see that connection. I don't think many people get the connection between a person who has a different national background than American versus people who have a national background that is American, but it's not white, middle-class American. There are similarities. There, of course, are differences, but there are similarities between what we say in our field, English language learners, and mainstream American English language learners, right? There are similarities, yet I think it's really hard for people to wrap their heads around, well, you are from another country, so therefore I understand the differences that you are bringing to the table linguistically, culturally, versus, but you live around the corner, so you should be able to speak this way and have this knowledge and understanding of the culture of mainstream society or school. Okay, next topic. How Feng mentioned language can be used to create barriers. And I believe he used the word use because I remember I was thinking, well, that's really an important point. Not that language creates barriers, because we all know that language does create barriers, right? You go to another country and you don't speak the language and it's harder. It's creating obstacles for you. Are you going to get the food that you thought you ordered? Are you going to get the room that you thought you booked, right? That's very obvious that language can create barriers. But I think the word he used, and that's why it stood out to me, was language can be used to create barriers, right? So I think there's, for me, I'm interpreting that, and I don't know if he meant it this way, but as in an intentional way, we can use language to create barriers, right? We can use language to exclude people from getting into certain programs, to exclude people from getting into certain organizations, to include people in your group, right, that you want to identify with, to include people, and this is going to sound a little juxtaposed, for labels, right? For labels, be it positive or negative. Oh, they're so cultured. Oh, they're so articulate, right? There's some labels there that we're using language to create a barrier. I just think that's fascinating and something to really think about, right? As beautiful as language is, and I absolutely love it and I love to talk about it, it can be used as a tool for setting up obstacles. And I think we see that on a daily basis, right? And if you really pay attention to it, and I've talked about this before, I think it's not just that we're using that language to create a barrier, we're using those nuances of the language, right? The person who's speaking it, their educational level, their race, their ethnicity, their immigration status, their income level. Those things all correlate. They correlate, not cause and effect, but they correlate with the language that we use. So when we use language to create barriers, we're actually using it as a proxy for those other identities. And it's something that we need to really focus on and pay attention to, right? Because to be honest, the way that Feng speaks and the language that he used in the English that he used, he said that he was, you know, cognizant of the written form of language that he uses and if it's correct or not. He was cognizant of his public speaking skills. Well, to me, Feng sounds perfectly fine and we communicate it perfectly fine and with the English that he uses and with the English that I use is really just defeating the purpose of effective communication. Now, of course, if you want the opposite to happen, by all means, that's probably what is happening. Lastly, I want to talk about language and thought. Or you'll hear people say things like language and cognition. There is this hypothesis out there called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. And you really hear about it if you're in linguistics. And as you know, I'm not a linguist. I say it all day, every day. But I think it's really important because when I first learned about it, I just thought it was fascinating. And basically just talks about two things, linguistic determinism, linguistic relativity. I don't want to go too crazy in this, but linguistic determinism refers to the concept that what is said has only some effect on how concepts are recognized by the mind. And linguistic relativity opens the window to the realization that all languages do not translate to each other. So I just read these definitions off of csufresno.edu. I really thought that was interesting that we got a great example from Feng about what this could actually look like. And let's even take away maybe the cognitive part of it because he highlighted the cultural part of knowing that even though you might learn a language, right? Even though you might learn English, right? So he speaks Cantonese and learning how to speak English. There are certain concepts and feelings and emotions and ideas that are still in him that he cannot express in English because there is no translation in English, right? I do not remember the word he said. I will not even try to say it. But that word that he used when he was talking about his puppy, Ryan, his puppy, was so excited about just being a puppy and wanted to play and, you know, put their teeth on, you know, Fung's skin, and a little too hard, a little too passionate. And there's a word for that in Cantonese, in his first language. And I think just to address that is just such an interesting thought to me, because it wasn't necessarily about the cognitive piece. He brought it more so about the cultural piece. When you have a name for something, one, it's very satisfying, right? It's very satisfying when it's like, oh my God, yes, you understand me. You get me, right? You have a connection with someone. You can come up with a similar idea and know that you have thought about the same thing, right? I can't tell you how many times I've been with my different groups of friends, right? So I'll be hanging out with like my Black girlfriends and we're all together and we'll talk about something and I can say it in a way that they completely understand me. And I know that if I were to say that same thing in another group of friends, they wouldn't understand it. But it's the same thing with other identities of mine, right? When I'm hanging around all my speech language pathology friends and they just get certain things without me having to explain it, oh, that feels so awesome. Right, I don't have to explain about what I meant when I said, you know, the morphosyntactic pluralism or, you know, anything like that. There's something to be said about that connection that language makes for us amongst our culture. That connection, right? And I love that. Yeah, I think we brought it up before in previous podcasts, but to really think about, wow, it is important for us to hold on to those first ways that we learn to speak, those first ways that make us feel home, that make us feel like that, right? I don't want us to get rid of those parts of us. And they're different for everyone. You know, my first is not AAE, grammatically, morphosyntactically, but it definitely is pragmatically, right? Socially, I grew up in a Black home, and there are certain things that I say with my family and do with my family and communicate with my family that just feels like home. Let's not get rid of those parts, right? Keep those parts true and celebrate them, and don't feel ashamed that you have to, I don't know, hide that part of you. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Honeybee Connection Podcast by MB. I know I did. If you did enjoy it, be sure to subscribe. And for more information on cultural assimilation, English language learners, and language and thought, check the notes below. If you'd like more information and resources on language and culture, or if you'd like to purchase my manual on classroom communication strategies, just head over to my website, www.meganbrutthamilton.com. You can also join my Facebook page, Honeybee Connection. Always remember, when you work with people, language matters, culture counts. Enjoy your day.